Application. You do the bell measurement. You get two classical bits. And based on that, you do some correction here. OK. Now, suppose after this you did some unitary. Well, then what you get out here would be u psi. Right? So what we're going to do is rewrite it. So we'll move this unitary earlier. And then this thing here has to kind of take that unitary into account, because we tried to commute the unitary through. So instead, we're going to do a up u dagger. So if this tells us we should do x, instead we do ux u dagger. Okay. And for certain u's, this thing is still a Pauli operator. So you're just rearranging the Pauli operators. So for instance, the controlled knot works that way, or the Hadamard transform. And then what you've done, you see, is you've created a particular Ancilla state that doesn't depend on the state you want to perform a gate on. And then broken it down to effectively teleportation using that particular Ancilla state. So the idea in linear optics, quantum computing, is you create this kind of state non-deterministically. And of course, it may take a number of tries to do that. But when you do it, you know modulo further errors. Then you do the teleportation again with very high probability, and then correct it and get the state with the gate on it. So because in linear optics there's some intrinsic source of errors, like this teleportation fails sometimes, then in order to really say that even in the idealized case where all your components are perfect, you still have to do error correction and fault tolerance on top of that just to get it to be actually valid. But
does it mean though, like, say you make a CZ gate, at best it might work 2/3 of the time, because mm-hmm. otherwise you'll get 2 qubits in the one mode and it'll be
right.
Like just an error.
Right.
Does this give you a higher?
Yeah. So the point is that these non-deterministic gates in linear optics are heralded.
Yes.
So there's some particular measurement outcome that you can see that tells you that it succeeded. So that's good for making these fixed ancillas, okay? Because they're not tied to the rest of the computation. You can make them. And if it succeeds, great. You've got a valid one you can use. If it fails, well, you knew that, and so you throw it out and try again.
Okay.
And then sooner or later, you're going to succeed, right? The chance of failing continuously decreases exponentially with the number of trials. So that's what's nice about this type of construction using non-deterministic gates. Sorry, what was the question? Maybe I already answered it.
I just read the paper that you could use teleportation to turn the non-deterministic linear optics gates into deterministic ones.
Right. So yeah. So that's true with a couple of caveats, like not being able to exactly do teleportation, and it's not totally deterministic because there's some probability that you'll continually fail in making these things. So really, what it means is gates with success probability arbitrarily close to one. Okay.
Ask another linear optics question?
Sure.
If there's some like quick way of saying it so I don't talk too much, how come the Bell basis measurement fails with some epsilon probability?
It turns out that if you had gone through all of that last problem part of the tutorial, well, you just have to read it. The problem was to distinguish three Bell states. So you're given one of three Bell states, and you wanted to say which one. But there was a note at the very end that it's not actually possible to do all four with linear optics. And so, is the question why can't you do that?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's been proven. I didn't look at the proof, so I can't tell you exactly how that proof works, but. Yeah, so I don't know if there's a nice intuitive way of understanding it or not. I just haven't looked at it.
Okay.
But basically, linear optics by itself is is kind of only somewhat powerful. And it doesn't give you full quantum computation, and which is why you need measurement to get the whole thing. Other questions? OK. Let's see. Since I've been talking about linear optics, quantum computation, maybe I should just finish that up and say a few more words. So so this is a construction that I drew up in response to an earlier question about how you perform quantum gates using teleportation. And the idea here is that in linear optics, well, you saw some of the tools you had available in the tutorial yesterday. And the idea is that by putting some of these tools together in certain ways, and in particular in post-selecting based on measurement results. So you have your photodetectors, and if they click, that tells you one thing. And if they don't click, that tells you something else. And so the idea is that conditioned on, say, certain photodetectors in your setup clicking, you can arrange things where you can do some sort of quantum gate. But the problem is it only happens with some probability. And you don't want to do that on your data, because if it failed, then that would mess up your computation. So the idea is you can use that to make spectral ancilla states, and then put it together with a construction to perform gates on the data. So actually, it turns out that this particular construction that I drew up, while it works for linear optics quantum computation, is probably not the best approach. A better way is using what's known as cluster states. So I'm not going to have time to really get into what cluster states are. But the idea is they're some big entangled state. And by making an adaptive series of measurements on them, on a cluster state, and by measurements, in this case, I mean single qubit measurements. You can perform any quantum computation. OK, so the idea here is you would make this big state using these non-deterministic linear optics gates. Okay, and you can kind of build it up piece by piece. So you build a part of it. If the gates sometimes work and sometimes fail, if it works, then great, you have a part. If it doesn't work, well, then you throw that part away. But you're doing this many times in parallel, right? So you have lots of these little pieces. Some of them succeed, some of them fail. And then you start to try to connect these pieces together. And sometimes that succeeds, and sometimes that fails. But the idea is that by setting up your protocol right, you can get it so that sometimes you'll succeed in creating a very big cluster state because you throw away the parts that don't work and keep the parts that do work. You can kind of selectively enhance your rate of success and succeed with essentially probably near one. And so you make this big cluster state. And then it's something that's very easy to do with linear optics and a lot of other systems, which is you just measure these individual photons. Well, for linear optics, it's photons. And based on the outcome of one measurement result, you make a different measurement on the next photon, and so on. And the upshot of all this, you have to do some a small classical computation at each step to figure out what the next measurement you should perform is. But based on that, you can then get a final outcome that is the same as you would have done if you had done some arbitrary quantum circuit. And this turns out to be a better way to do linear optics quantum computation than the original idea, which was involve these teleportation gates. OK. So today I want to talk about a variety of different implementations and not give you nearly as much detail as we went into yesterday. So yesterday we talked about ion traps. And I guess there's maybe a few things I didn't say about ion traps. So for one thing, I didn't tell you what's already been done. So ion traps are one of the leading implementations in as far as the current experimental reality. So people have done, I would say, 4 to 8 qubit experiments. Depending on exactly what level of control you want to talk about. But that's pretty good. There's not too many things, not too many systems in which we've done more than that. Really, only NMR is a candidate for more than that. So the ion traps satisfy basically all of the DiVincenzo criteria I talked about. The one that's maybe a little bit tricky is scalability. So you can only put so many ions in a single trap before it starts to run into problems. And so in order to make a really big quantum computer out of ion traps, you need some way to link these traps together. So to do that, people are kind of exploring a couple of different ways. So one way, one method is to physically move the ions. And that's actually been demonstrated. So this is certainly one promising approach. The other approach, which has now also been demonstrated, is to connect separate ion traps with light. So in particular, in this case, we want to trap the ions in optical cavities. So what that means is you have a resonator here, which has a size that's proportional to the wavelength of light. And you have, you know, maybe one or two atoms trapped, or three or four even, trapped in this optical cavity. And so in this case, the cavity mode for photons can replace the phonon mode that we used before in the ion trap. These things still have a phonon mode, but it's kind of, in some cases, much more convenient to use the photon mode. And what happens is this light, you set it up so that it can sometimes leak out. And you can't avoid that it sometimes leaks out. But actually, they specifically make it so that it'll leak out preferentially in a certain place. Right? So these things can have very, very high Q, which is the number of times the light will reflect back and forth before it escapes. But if you make a little patch where it's a bit lower reflectivity, then it's more likely to escape there. And then you have some sort of control over it. And so the idea is if you have two such things, and the light leaks out, then eventually you put it through, you take the light that's leaking out of these two things and put it through a beam splitter. Okay? And you measure one of the outputs of this beam splitter. And the idea is that since the light doesn't leak out very often, if you happen to see a photon here, there was probably only one photon that leaked out from one of these two cavities. And because of the beam splitter, that photon could be from either cavity. So if before we had one photon in each cavity, well, we've post-selected. So that's the kind of the jargon for what you do when you make a measurement and kind of ignore what happens when you don't see the desired measurement result. In this case, the desired measurement result is there's a click in the photodetector. So we post-select on seeing a click in the photodetector. In that case, like I said, it could have come from either cavity. And in fact, it should be a quantum superposition of having come from either cavity. If you can get the amplitudes matched, then it'll be a balanced superposition. And so either you'll have the photon leak from this cavity, and then there'll still be one in this one, right, which looks like that, or it'll be the other way around. And voila, you have an entangled state between the two cavities, cavity modes. And therefore can teleport qubits between them. And that allows you to hook up lots and lots of little cavities into one kind of more integrated big quantum computer. Yeah. Right.
Then you can start with that one state. And mm-hmm. it will slowly evolve into a mixed state of 1-1 and 0-1 plus 1-0. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, of course, you'd also get 0-0 increasing in amplitude inside the mixed state.
Right. But after an intermediate time, it'll basically be a mixed state. And the idea here is that there's another output here, okay, which kind of corresponds to the 0-1 minus 1-0 state.
Right.
And if you don't know which of these happens, then you have to take a mixture of the plus and the minus, okay, which is the same as the mixture of 0-1 with 1-0.
Okay.
So this is actually this non-uniqueness of the decomposition of a density matrix into a mixture of pure states. And it's, I mean, you can see it playing a very important role in understanding what's going on here.
So it is, if you don't have the detector there, all you know about the system is that it's in this mixed state.
Right, and you don't really even know that, right? Because the amount of time it takes for this light to escape is pretty uncertain.
So it's a
mixed state of this and
right.
and this and this and even right. the 0-0.
So, yeah. So you can still do operations on it, but you don't know, because you don't know enough about the system, you don't know what the answers will be at the end.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Okay.
That's one way of looking at it. So, for instance, if somebody did this photodetection and this one, but didn't tell you, and then you went ahead and did stuff, then you could really understand it as, well, you're doing some sort of operation, but you don't know exactly what it is. Then later somebody could tell you what it was, and then you'd know, right? So, for instance, if you do teleportation with the minus state instead of the plus state, then the state that comes out at the end will have the phases messed up. And you know, if you keep careful track of what you do, when somebody later tells you that you're at the minus state, then maybe you can go back and fix them. But if you never find out, then it's just kind of the same as if it were around the line. Yeah.
So if you're going along and doing quantum computation with your ion trap, and you mm-hmm. have to go over to a nearby ion trap to continue your computation, you have to sit and wait for photon emissions to occur?
I think people are still figuring out the best way to do these architectures. But one option is to just say, well, I'm just going to constantly try to create these entangled pairs so that I'll have some around when I need them. Okay. And the other thing is that once you create an entangled pair, using the photon, I mean, the whole point of putting these ions in the trap was so that they could interact with this photon mode. And so once you have an entangled state between the photon modes of the cavity, you can switch it into the ions and store it for a long time. And that's actually one of the main points of this type of protocol. I mean, even if you're not interested in really computation, but simply long-range communication, this lets you, you know, wait until you can generate an EPR pair and then store it until you need it, which is already a big improvement over what we can do now. Now we have things that can create pairs of photons, but then you have to use them when you get them. So it maybe it's worth saying that if you have an EPR pair that you created at some source, you might say, well, okay, I'll just go the other way and I'll absorb those photons into the cavities. That turns out not to work so well because you can't reliably get them into the cavities. Getting them out of the cavities Well, you can't really do that reliably either. And that's the point of the scheme, is that it just has to happen sooner or later, but not necessarily at the time that you control. OK? So I guess one more thing I want to say about ion traps is this is an example of a system where the gates are fairly slow, OK? But the decoherence times are very long. And I mean, atoms or ions trapped in magnetic bottles are used for the very best atomic clocks. And the reason for that is because the decoherence times are so long and these systems are very stable. So what that means in practice is that you have gate times on the order of microseconds, I believe. Okay, so this is obviously, if you built a quantum computer this way, the individual gates would be much, much slower than the individual gates in really any significant classical computer today. But the idea, of course, is that we'd presumably be running some algorithms that are so much faster that we can make up for the slower gate time. Okay, I mean, if you run Shor's algorithm to factor a 1,000-bit number, it'll still be much, much faster on an ion trap quantum computer than it would be on a classical computer. Well, you couldn't run Shor's algorithm at all, but if you run some other factoring algorithm. Yeah? Oh, well, you know, so if you buy a new computer today, I mean, the clock time is like gigahertz, right? A few gigahertz. So that's so that's so the inverse of that is gate time, right? So it's less than a nanosecond. Classical computers gotten pretty fast. Okay. So let's now move to another. Oh yeah.
Is there a lower bound on the gate times from uncertainty principle?
So I think if you, so it depends a little bit on what you're doing, actually. So if you go the original ion trap route, where you're interacting the qubits via the phonon mode, it's the two-qubit gates that's a slow one. And there must be some bound that has to do with that. And I'm not sure exactly what sets it. You can actually, I think, if you go this route and use the photon mode instead of the phonon mode, I think you can actually do gates substantially faster in this case. But you might still be limited because, you know, if you shine too much light, so to speed up gates, you have to shine more intense lasers. And that causes all sorts of problems eventually. So there's a complicated series of trade-offs for exactly how fast you can run these things. But it tends to be set by kind of the frequency scale of the main components. OK, so the next one I want to talk about, NMR. So that stands for, of course, nuclear magnetic resonance. So NMR is a oh yeah, okay.
Sorry, I have one last question.
Sure.
How well can it be like miniaturized or?
Yeah. So people are, that's something that people are working on right now. So I mean, you know, kind of the standard ion traps are not that small. They have you need a vacuum chamber and of course you have all the lasers pointing in. These things, you know, they sit on an optical bench, but they're big. But people are working on making kind of fabricated micro traps. And I think some of that has been done. I don't know the state of the art of how many. I don't know if there's fabricated ones that can hold, you know, 4 qubits yet. But that's kind of in progress at the moment.
Okay. But
so there's no intrinsic reason that you can't make very small ones, because okay. The atoms are very small.
Yeah.
Actually, for most of these things that I'll be talking about, the kind of the quantum computer part itself is some very small thing. It kind of has to be because it's quantum. But then there's, you know, some very large amount of support technology around it to make it all work and do the control. And so in some cases, that's susceptible to miniaturization. In some cases, less so. So NMR is one case where it's the support technology is maybe not so susceptible to miniaturization. And the reason for that is what you do is you have some little liquid sample inside a giant magnet. And you need a giant magnet because you need very strong magnetic fields. And so in this case, the quantum computer, well, you can think of it as just a molecule. And it's in a large magnetic field. And the idea of the magnetic field is that it's going to separate the energies of the nuclear spin states. So for instance, so an example molecule is alanine. It's been used. What does alanine look like? And so actually, you don't use standard alanine. You use what's labeled, carbon 13 alanine. So the idea is we need nuclei with spin 1/2. That's not, I mean, absolutely essential. You could use any spin except for 0. But the idea is then that the up and down states of the nuclear spin are the qubit. And it turns out that carbon 13 has spin 1/2 and is very good for this type of application for a number of reasons. So one reason is that there's two real reasons. So one of them is that NMR is kind of a very well-studied technology for, say, medical imaging and, in general, studying of biological molecules. I mean, not only biological molecules, but that's one of the major applications. And of course, carbon shows up in biological molecules. That's kind of the basis of our chemistry. But and so there's a lot of developed techniques for working specifically with carbon and you know, hydrogen and similar things that show up in these molecules. But carbon and hydrogen are kind of the favorite ones to use as qubits. Hydrogen also, you know, just one proton, of course, that's spin 1/2. But carbon 12, the most common isotope, doesn't have spin 1/2, which is why you have to go to carbon 13 if you want to see this spin 1/2. And the other reason that carbon is nice from a quantum computing point of view is that you can get these molecules that have very long carbon chains, and they could be arbitrarily long. So at least in principle, you could have a molecule that has arbitrarily many qubits, right? That would be a problem if you were using something that didn't form large molecules. If your quantum computer is a single molecule, then that would limit the number of qubits you have. Okay. So, yeah.
Why specifically spin 1/2?
Oh, yeah. So I said that an aside. That it's not really essential. I mean, you could use spin 1 or spin 3/2, but spin 1/2 is nice because it gives you a qubit.
Oh, okay.
That's all.
Okay.
I mean, it simplifies matters, but it's not really essential. Okay. So so then, how does this work in a little more detail? So each nucleus, at least the ones that you're working with, has a different splitting frequency. Between the up and the down. And the reason for that is because each is in a slightly different chemical environment. So interactions with the nearby atoms will shift the frequencies. cause a chemical shift. Okay, so for instance, you can see this carbon is next to some oxygens, and this one is next to nitrogen. And sorry, this is not a C13. Let me put it here. Use carbon 15. And this one is just three hydrogens. So each of these has different neighbors, and therefore, you know, the electrons get pulled to the neighbors in different amounts and in different directions. And therefore, the frequencies of these three carbons will all be slightly different. And that's nice because it means if you put these frequencies tend to be radio frequencies. So you can use an RF pulse to address the individual atoms. OK. Who wants to go first?
By frequency, I guess I don't understand what.
Oh, I just mean that there's energy levels between difference between the ground and the excited.
Okay.
And the reason you have this actually at all is because of the magnetic field.
Right.
Okay. But the exact amount shifts depending on exactly which atom you have. Is that your question too, or?
No.
Okay.
My question is, you were saying that in principle you can have an arbitrarily long chain of carbons. And does that mean though that each carbon has to have a different chemical environment in order to not?
Yeah, that's a complication. So in the cases where people talk about arbitrary long chains, then what they expect is there'll be, say, you know, maybe three different frequencies or five different frequencies or whatever. Three is enough, but more makes it maybe a bit easier. So you have three different frequencies, and so you can address, you know, all the type A carbons and then all the type B carbons and all the type C carbons separately. But you have to kind of limit yourself to doing things that do this kind of global control of a specific type of atom. For the small experiments, people like to be able to address all of them individually. But if you really wanted to scale this up, you'd have to be a bit more clever.
How could you get a universal system then if you can individually?
Well, you can. It's somewhat complicated.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a short way of explaining it, but basically you have to be kind of clever. The important thing, this is why you need three, because that lets you kind of distinguish between left and right. And then, you know, you encode things in a certain way, and by doing an appropriate sequence of pulses, you can actually simulate a universal quantum computation. You need something different on the end to kind of feed information in. But other than that. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah.
Like, naively, I would expect that, like, so if you just had a carbon atom in a magnet, then the frequency splitting, you can calculate it. If you have a molecule, because of the different environments, as you said, you get different energy level splitting.
Right.
But I would expect that the differences in splitting sort of depend on like how the molecule is oriented in the field.
Right. So okay. So that's something I'm gonna get to in a little bit. The thing is, it doesn't really. So first of all, I'm characterizing it by saying that, well, right now I've said so far that you could think of a single molecule as a quantum computer. But of course, this little test tube has many, many, many molecules in it. And it actually is a liquid state in the most standard NMR. And so what happens is they tumble around. Now the direction of the field kind of sets the energy splitting in the qubit is going to, the up and down direction is preferred one, right? It's the z direction. So at least, you know, when you use these RF pulses to your single qubit gates, you know that you're really rotating in one direction or the other relative to the standard computational basis. The chemical shifts, I don't think it really does depend on the direction that these things are relative to the field. But what is true is that the tumbling of these atoms actually is a good thing, in that, well, let me get back to that in a minute when I talk more about the ensemble nature of this. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So as I kind of mentioned briefly, these RF pulses to address individual atoms, this is how you do single qubit gates. And by putting in a pulse around an appropriate axis, you can do a rotation about any direction you like. And so the single qubit gates are pretty easy. Kind of. So actually, it turns out that the two-qubit gates are even easier. So why is that? And how can you be easier than just sending a single RF pulse to control it? Well, the idea is that, remember we said that these neighboring atoms will interact to cause a chemical shift. But that's also true between the carbons. And what's more, there's a spin-spin interaction. It's kind of these nuclear spins correspond to hyperfine levels. And so the nuclei effectively interact between neighboring carbons, or neighboring, I mean, you don't have to use carbons, but neighboring atoms. And typically, you get some kind of ZZ interaction between the qubits. The actual strength of this coupling will depend on, more details of the chemistry of this thing and what kinds of atoms they are and what the other atoms are around them, et cetera. And that's important, actually, because it means the frequencies are different. But the point is that if you don't do anything, you still have this ZZ coupling. So you perform a phase gate. E to the minus I T ZZ over H bar, times some coupling constant K. Okay, and this if you do it like for pi or pi over 2, you'll get exactly this controlled sine gate that we talked about yesterday. Wait, is that right? Anyway, you'll get some 2-qubit phase gate, that's good, right? That's what you wanted. You wanted a 2-qubit gate, and then you have 1-qubit gates. The problem is that this thing continues to go even if you don't want to do it. So what you need is a way to turn it off. So it's doing 2-qubit gates is easy. It's not doing 2-qubit gates that's hard. So to turn off this interaction, you have to do something called refocusing or decoupling, or it goes by a variety of names. The idea is this. So what you do is you wait for some time, and then so during that time, of course, this interaction will be going on, and so then you flip one bit. So that's an X. And then you wait for time t again. And then you flip the bit again. So what does that do? Well, you did a time t of this interaction. Then you did a bit flip. And then you did time t again. And then another bit flip. Now, the thing is that x, well, let's make this x tensor I, so make it more clear. So we're flipping the first bit here. So x anti-commutes with z. Okay? So if you try to swap these two operators, this e to the minus I t z tensor z will become e to the plus I z tensor z. And then it'll cancel this. So this just boils down to x tensor I. And then it cancels this x tensor I. And so overall, you've done nothing. OK? It's a lot of work to do nothing, but you can manage it. Yeah?
If you're looking at how it's usually interaction, when each carbon atom has four neighboring atoms, right?
Yes.
Then there's going to be some frustration.
Yes. So in fact, if you want to do this in a full molecule, you need to do some more complicated thing that cancels out all of those interactions. Now actually, it's not quite as bad as that, right? Because you have a sum of ZZ for different, for all the different neighbors. But if you flip the carbon atom, then it'll anti-commute with ZZ. No matter what the other, so one Z is on this carbon atom, and the other one is on a different neighbor, okay? And all of those anti-commute with X. So just flipping the one carbon atom will cancel all of the interactions that involve that atom.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, say that again.
Like, if you had just two atoms, then you can say,
sure.
If you can have
sure. Right.
The presence of the dead atom at like frustrate the system now.
So you mean like if you have a ring? Yeah, well, potentially, except that I think in practice, actually, it doesn't matter. Because these ZZs, it really all commute. And it's so to get rid of them, you really only need these bit flips. So obviously, this molecule doesn't have any ring. So you don't. This problem doesn't arise. You know, the common one that does have a ring is a benzene, which is you know, benzene ring with, you know, different things hanging off it, which is even. So you're not going to have this problem. I don't know. It's possible there is some kind of frustration problem. My impression is that in general you can do this for pretty much any configuration. I don't know if that's rigorously true or just kind of true in practice. But if it is a problem, then you just have to be careful to choose molecules that don't have that problem. Yeah?
So this means that all your two qubit gates have to be local?
Yeah. So, I mean, there is some slower ZZ interaction between further away qubits. But most of the time, you want to do it between the neighbors. And that's OK. Remember, we talked about, I mean, I kind of said it in passing, that, you know, that you should get the same kind of computational class, complexity class, if you're dealing with nearest neighbor gates in one dimension versus, you know, you can do gates between any qubit. This means that it's kind of slowed down, because if you want to interact qubits that are far away, you have to swap them together and then interact them and then move them back apart. It's a pain in the neck, but at least in principle, it's still universal. That's right. OK, so there's one other big thing that we have to take into account in this NMR. We know how to do one and two qubit gates. But the problem is, if you look at the DiVincenzo criteria, we don't know how to do initialization or measurement. And actually, this is an example of something which kind of violates the DiVincenzo criteria, the NMR. This is something that sometimes goes by the name ensemble quantum computation. And the idea is Well, again, we don't have just one molecule in the sample. We have many, many of them. And by many, many, I mean, you know, like 10 to the 23rd, 10 to the 24th, something like that. And the problem is that we also do this at room temperature. And at room temperature, the temperature, or kT anyway, is much, much greater than the energy splitting. Okay? And so the upshot is that we start the computation in a thermal state. And in the thermal state, well, a single qubit looks like this, basically. And delta, you know, typically is on the order of 10 to the minus 5, something like that. Okay? So there's only one in 10 to the fifth qubits is preferentially up versus down. So I should say one thing is that, so this is where the liquid state property actually becomes important. Because these atoms are tumbling in the magnetic field, the off-diagonal matrix elements really do cancel out very well. So even if you look at just this, like a single molecule, this is a pretty good approximation. This is kind of a technical note, but it's one reason why liquid state NMR is a lot easier than solid state NMR. So anyway, so somehow you have to go from this to something that you can use for quantum computation. And so what's done in practice is so you average out the other cases. So what we like to do is rewrite this. We want to do some gates. I don't want to go into detail about this because I want to at least mention some other implementations. But we rewrite this as something that looks like this. Okay, you know, over two, I guess in this case, since it's one qubit. And the idea is that then when we make a measurement, well, we're not measuring a single molecule either. We're measuring some average over many molecules. And then the identity, it'll cancel out because you have, I mean, anything is equally likely. So the average there is going to be zero. And so it's only the average of this small polarization that we see. Okay. Again, in the interest of time, I won't really say much about this averaging out. The way people do it nowadays is called, I mean, well, there's a couple of different ways, but the problem is the way they do it nowadays is exponentially inefficient with the number of qubits. They have to kind of mix up all the possible other states other than the 0, 0, 0 initial state. And there's exponentially many of those, and So it takes a lot of resources to do that. And effectively, you get much smaller. This delta has not been the same as this delta. It's a much smaller thing. So that's not good for scalability. But it's good enough that people have done, you know, up to about, you know, 11 or 12 qubits in experiments. But in principle, you can do much better by kind of rearranging things. And if you have a really big molecule, then you can maybe make a fraction, kind of rearrange it so that most of the qubits are in the totally mixed state, but a small number of them are in the all zero state. And unfortunately, the small number is, you know, 1 out of 10 to the fifth or something. So you need a really big molecule to make this work. But at least in principle, this thing is scalable. Yeah. One zero zero zero. So this is the point, is this doesn't happen automatically. You can't just say this is equal to this. That's not the case. I mean, I guess it is kind of the case, depending on what the constants are. But the point is you have to do a little bit of work. I mean, for one qubit, it's not a big deal. But for two qubits, it's important, because you really want this, which won't happen unless you intervene. And this is why you actually have to do something to average out these other three states, so that they all have the same energy, effectively. Or not same energy, same occupation number. They don't have the same energy. That's because you want, you know, kind of a pure state for your computation to work on. OK?
Would it help them to lower temperature? I mean, or is there some other problem?
So it does help to lower temperature. But the problem is that, well, we're doing this with liquids. Right, and if you lower the temperature too much, they're going to freeze. There's other problems too. I don't really know the technical details here. But if you lower them enough, then they'll freeze, and then you really can't do this at all. There is another whole realm of solid state NMR. It's much harder, but you can get much much higher polarizations. So in the explorations quantum computation course, David Corey, I don't know if he's going to say anything about NMR, but there's at least a good chance. And if you ask him questions, he'll be able to answer the questions much, much better than me, because he actually does work with that. He's one of the world's experts. OK. So in the remaining time, let me quickly, so one more thing. So NMR is actually, because you're using radio frequency pulses, it's actually really even slower than the ion traps. So maybe, you know, roughly a millisecond is your gate time. And again, it's a two-qubit gate, or turning off the two-qubit gates that are slow. But NMR has, so spins, in particular nuclear spins, are very well isolated. So they stay coherent for a very long time. So sometimes they even have, you know, seconds or even longer in some cases, coherence time. So again, you have a reasonable ratio of gate time to coherence time. OK? So then in the remaining time, let me just quickly mention a number of other implementations. So I mentioned linear optics. We've done ion traps, NMR. So maybe it's time to go to a solid state condensed matter implementation. So superconductors. So superconductors have, over the past decade, have started to emerge as a really viable technology for quantum computing. They haven't caught up to ion traps, but there has certainly been very impressive progress. So superconductors are now at the two-qubit stage, maybe more. I mean, I think the next generation of them will have 3 or 4 qubits. So superconductors, the main tool you use is a Josephson junction, of course. And Josephson junction is nice because it really has this kind of quantum tunneling. You need to look at very small superconductor rings and, you know, very finely things, so that you really have a quantum superposition of different possible states rather than just some kind of classical. Believe it or not, there's kind of a classical limit of superconductors. From the point of view of quantum computation, I mean, normally when people talk about superconductors, they say, oh, this is an intrinsically quantum thing. But nevertheless, if you have a big superconductor, you really still kind of get classical values of the currents and the magnetic fields. But if you go to a small superconductor, which is still many, many atoms, you know, millions of or more atoms, you do start to get quantum effects that are enough to really talk about superposition and quantum computing. So anyway, so the Josephson junction is nice because it gives you a lot of control over these superconductors. And there's kind of three general class of superconducting qubits. So there's charged qubits. So in charged qubits, you tend to have islands of superconducting material. and maybe you'll have, you know, one extra Cooper pair. And the location of that pair is your qubit. And then these islands are going to be connected with Josephson junctions, and you can control them, you know, using kind of general electronic circuitry. Okay. So another kind. So the problem with these is that the charges tend to decohere relatively rapidly. So these things were maybe favored early on. They're relatively easy to construct and to think about. But in practice, doing quantum computation with them is pretty difficult. So what's more favored are these next two types. So there's flux qubits. What's the third one? Is phase qubit. So in both of these, you have some sort of a superconducting ring, and frequently there'll be, you know, one or more Josephson junctions, usually more. Three seems to be a common number to within this ring to give you some control. And in the flux qubit, well, you can, I mean, the details of this are kind of complicated, and I actually don't understand them very well. But the magnetic flux through the ring kind of acts as your qubit. So you could have, you know, in or out, for instance. In or out. As your 0 or 1. Okay? And of course, then you can have superpositions. And to have, of course, a superposition of magnetic fluxes, you need to have a very small ring. And then in the phase qubit, well, then it's the superconducting phase drop around the ring. So you know a superconductor has this phase. Have you guys done superconductors in any of your previous courses? Maybe not. OK. Well, OK. So I'm definitely not the person to tell you about them, because I don't know all that much about superconductors myself. But in superconductors, there's this quantum phase that's really very important in the theory. And because you have a loop, the superconducting phase at different points in this ring can vary. And in particular, you can get jumps across the Josephson junction. And so the superconducting phase and the value of that, the overall value when you go around the ring, you can think of that as your qubit. And these Josephson junctions can act as nonlinear, weird nonlinear inductors. And so this lets you interact multiple qubits. Okay, by having the inductances from, say, two different rings talk to each other. Yeah?
So that means the qubit gates are local on a 2D lattice?
Yeah, typically. Again, there can be some longer range thing, but they shouldn't be. It's not going to be too long. That's quite a lot of systems have only local gates. LOQC, linear optics, is nice because the photons move around, and that gives you long-range gates. This one, well, within the ion trap, most of your gates are going to be, well, you can have, you know, long-range within the ion trap, but that's only a few qubits. And then maybe you have to connect them together. So it depends what you're doing. If you're moving the ions, then nearby gates are preferred. If you're connecting with light, it's not such a big deal.
Right. It's just locality seems more important when you're...
When you have a physically constructed... Yeah.
Are not very mobile.
Yeah, that's right. So actually, there are ideas to connect these superconductors to put them in waveguides. And this has been demonstrated experimentally, that you can actually connect to kind of propagating electromagnetic modes. Okay. So like I said, these are a popular rising thing. And one reason is that, I mean, it's kind of easy to imagine manufacturing large numbers of these using solid-state manufacturing techniques. And another reason is that they're really very fast. They're certainly much faster than these other things I've talked about. So here the gate time is going to be on the order of nanoseconds. Right, so gigahertz frequencies again. So this is maybe going to be comparable to, you know, today's computers and speed per gate, of course. For something that you want to do a quantum computation for, it's going to be much, much faster. Okay. So I'm pretty much out of time, but regular eraser is gone. I'll use this. So let me just mention a couple of more. Actually, I shouldn't erase that. Come on. A couple of more implementations very quickly. So other ones. So quantum dots. So these superconductors, well, you can make them using solid-state manufacturing techniques. But it would be really nice if we could make something out of silicon, because there's this gigantic computer industry that's gotten really good at making things out of silicon. And so that's one advantage of quantum dots. So what is a quantum dot? Well, a quantum dot is some well of semiconducting material. That has, you know, a few energy levels in it. So it's sometimes called an artificial atom. And so the idea is you can manufacture such a thing and then use, well, in principle, you could use the ground and excited state as qubit. In practice, it's actually better to use the spins. Spins tend to be better isolated from the environment, so they have longer decoherence time. And you can interact two of these by having them tunnel from one to one well to another. So in particular, the Pauli exclusion principle says that if, you know, you have a spin up electron and the other well already has a spin up electron, well, it's not going to be able to tunnel into lowest energy level. So this gives you, on the other hand, if there's a spin up here and a spin down here, then it can tunnel, right? So that gives you some kind of interaction that depends on the state of the spins. It can tunnel in one case and not in the other case. And so this is called the exchange interaction. And that's how you do two qubit gates. In practice, these quantum dots seem to be hard to work with. So let's say they're somewhere in the 1 to 2 qubit range at best. They're definitely lagging behind superconductors. And I think most people who don't work on them are more pessimistic about that as a long-range approach. And then let me very quickly mention one final thing. One final implementation, which is optical lattices. So an optical lattice involves crisscrossing lasers. And where these lasers, I mean, this is a simplification, obviously. So maybe you can imagine these lines as the, you're going to, so these stabbing waves. And so the stabbing waves will have nodes and antinodes, right? Places where it's, you have a big oscillation, places where you have no field at all. And so you can imagine, I'm not actually sure whether it's the nodes or antinodes that are the best places. But you have lasers in one direction, we'll have nodes in one way, and the other way they'll have it the other way. And actually, you should do this in 3D. And so then where these cross, you'll have little places where the atoms like to sit. And typically, we use neutral atoms here. And so these atoms like to form a lattice. And in fact, you can load these things with a BEC to basically fill this very evenly with one atom per site. BEC, Bose-Einstein condensate, in case you don't know. And then by shifting the phase of one polarization, of the lasers, you can cause the atoms to move, but not only that, you can cause them to move in a way that depends on their internal state. By internal state, I mean the electronic state. Okay, and then you can like cause them to collide in a state-dependent way. So this means that since it's a quantum state, they'll actually be in a superposition of locations and cause interactions, for instance, that way. So the difficulty with this implementation is that it's hard to address the atoms individually. So it's possible this has been done by now, but I'm not sure. I certainly haven't heard of an experiment, but it might have been there's one in the last year or maybe two. But this might be a very good way to get lots and lots of atoms. So people are looking at this kind of system. First of all, they're coming up with ways to address individual atoms. You might want to do something that kind of instead deals with all the atoms at once, like some kind of quantum simulation. You simulate some kind of spin system using this. And there's some simple examples of that have been done. And the idea is, well, all the spins in the spin system are doing the same thing. So that's something that you can actually do using this type of system. Whereas something, a more complicated quantum computation where you have to do separate things on the individual atoms, that's more difficult. OK, so I'm way over time, but that's the end of the course. I guess there's a couple of announcements. The first one is, I mentioned earlier in the week that there was this QKD experiment between PI and IQC, and some people seemed interested in that. So Ray Laflamme said that if you are interested, you should talk to him, and he'll put you on the list for the next time they do a demonstration, which I don't know when that's going to be, but it might be a while, but then he can contact you. So a couple of people wanted to talk to me about projects or other things. So now that I'm finally done preparing the class, maybe you can email me to set that up. I don't know. Is there anything else? Final questions? Going away questions? I'm not disappearing. I'll be at PI, of course. So you'll be able to ask me questions. Yeah. Yeah.
Anything about topological quantum computing?
Yeah, so that's definitely another possibility. I didn't want to get into it because it's maybe a little more complicated. So you want me to say something about what it is, or?
I don't know. I guess if it's convoluted, I can talk to you like after the class.
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to talk about it, but you know, the next class is probably going to start soon, so maybe we should do it outside. Yeah.
Has anyone done an experimental implementation of topological quantum computing?
Yes and no. Depends what you consider an experimental implementation. Nothing that I would say reaches a clear one qubit stage. I think the main thing people are trying, I mean, there's a couple of different approaches to doing something that could be called topological quantum computing. Maybe the clearest example is in these quantum Hall systems. And the main thing they're trying to do there is demonstrate that there really are non-abelian statistics. And so to do that, you have to do some kind of interference experiment, which is inspired by topological quantum computing. And I'm not sure if that's been done yet. It probably has been by now, but I haven't seen the appropriate results myself. So I don't know what the status of that is exactly.
Thank you for giving us the answers and the answers.